From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And in a few minutes, NPR's Domenico Montanaro will join us with his thoughts on last night's debate. But first, let's hear from some voters. And Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd in Las Vegas.
Republicans from Clark County, Nevada, gathered at a swanky restaurant just south of the Las Vegas Strip. That's where I met the group's chairman, Dwight Mazzoni, seconds before the debate began. He was feeling pretty good about his candidate, Donald Trump.
I expect it's the last chance for Hillary Clinton in the debate. That's really what I'm expecting. I think Donald's going to do a good job. I hope he can keep his cool. I hope she can keep her cool and that they can have a good, lively debate.
And from this vantage point, it was lively.
Look, she's been proven to be a liar on so many different ways. This is just another lie.
The Republicans cheered when Trump questioned Hillary Clinton's trustworthiness, and they jeered the Democrat for her stance on Syrian refugees.
I am not going to let anyone into this country who is not vetted, who we do not have confidence in, but I am not going to slam the door.
Immigration is a hot topic here in Nevada with its growing Latino and Asian population, so the crowd got feisty anytime the topic came up. But Republicans here also loved any mention of WikiLeaks, especially when moderator Chris Wallace brought up Clinton's leaked statements about free trade in a 2013 speech to a Brazilian bank.
For which you were paid $225,000.
My mind, I think Trump did it. I think he hit a home run tonight to me.
Clark County GOP Chairman Dwight Mazzoni got what he was looking for when we spoke after the event. He said Trump improved upon his past two debate performances. He seemed presidential, he didn't interrupt as much, and did well enough to help himself win the election, despite sagging poll numbers.
It's going to be a battle, but I think it's a good battle. I think there's a lot more silent people out there that publicly will say they're not for him, but privately, when they go into that voting booth to pull the handle, they're going to be voting for Trump.
You still feel okay?
I still feel very good about it, very strong about the fact that Trump will be our next president.
Conservative blogger Megan Barth also felt good about Trump's chances after the night was over, though she said he should have been more aggressive, highlighting Clinton's vulnerabilities.
And so I think we could have spent a little bit more time on her emails. I think we could have spent a little bit more time, and it didn't have to get personal, but certainly to chip away at the unfavorability rating that Hillary Clinton suffers from, as well as he does. So this is really a contest between who can make more, which candidate can make which candidate more unfavorable.
But there was at least one person in this very pro-Trump crowd who had some major concerns. Tyson Pine was still undecided going into the debate.
I thought it was memorable when he didn't. He wouldn't say that he would accept the election.
He's referring to Trump's refusal to back away from claims that the election is rigged even before the votes are counted, and that he'd keep us in suspense about his concession if he lost the election.
I think that's kind of a dangerous thing to say. No matter what the election is, you know, if you don't believe in democracy, maybe you shouldn't be running for president. Like, it's such a pivoted a part of this country.
Pine left the debate party a little closer to voting for Hillary Clinton, and he'd have plenty of allies across town at this event.
I'm helping Nevada turn blue to protect the United States from a terrorist.
Carrie Young is one of many Democratic organizers who gathered in a Las Vegas office building to help ramp up support for Clinton in this western battleground state.
You know, he's just the wrong person. I'm terrified, really, honestly, because for someone who degrades people, I don't want you teaching my grandchildren that that's okay.
They ate pizza and tacos, cheering and booing at lines from the candidates, like this one of Trump using a Spanish word to talk about border security and drug dealers.
We have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
Or this one, defending his treatment of women.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do.
After the fireworks had ended, community organizers Artie Blanco and Blanca Gomez were satisfied.
At the end of the day, there were a lot of issues that were talked about today, and everybody got to see that Hillary Clinton is definitely ready to lead, while Donald Trump is not, and he's just playing games and thinks he's still on a reality TV show.
I'm glad they spoke about the issues. That's the most important part. I think that was failing in the last past two debates, that we weren't even really talking about the issues. It's just banter between the both of them. But today we really got into the issues, especially immigration reform, which is something, of course, for me personally as a dreamer, I really care about and wanted to hear it more about.
And that's the surprising common ground that both Democrats and Republicans could agree on. With less than 3 weeks now before Election Day, both Trump and Clinton supporters say they were pleased that this final debate stayed mostly focused on issues that matter to them and the country. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Las Vegas.
Well, let's bring in Domenico Montanaro now. He's lead editor for politics at NPR. And Domenico, let's get to some news that we've got here. Donald Trump was at the Delaware, Ohio County Fair and said he'd now accept the election results if he wins. And then shortly later, he said he will accept clear election results but reserve his right to contest. Now, is he in sort of backing away from his claim last night that, you know, he wouldn't say what he would do? Is he reacting to voters like the one we just heard in Peter's piece who said, hey, if you can't accept a democracy, don't run? Is he reacting to this storm, this outcry?
I interpreted it a little differently. Huh. I don't really see him backing away from his claim that the election would be rigged. He kind of went on this riff of conspiracy as to why the election could be rigged. And he, you know, maybe in spots tamped it down a little bit. But the idea that he reserves his right, you know, doesn't have, he said it would be unprecedented for someone to give up their right to be able to do recounts. Well, first of all, that's not how election law works. You know, like just because if you're saying an election is rigged, like when you say an election is rigged, that's different than, you know, being able to say, I want to recount ballots like Al Gore did in 2000 or anywhere or anybody who's ever run. If the state law calls for a recount under a certain amount of votes, but whatever, like that, it just seems like that doesn't matter. He just glosses over it and he's going, you know, right to the heart of what his supporters want to hear.
Well, we also just heard in Peter's piece, a GOP chair say that in his mind, Trump hit a home run last night. Now, CNN overnight poll of viewers said Clinton won the debate by 52-39. I'm not sure if those are CNN viewers. A CBS Battleground poll says Clinton won the debate 49-39. 12% called it a tie. How would you characterize it? He just about everyone felt he did very well in the beginning.
He did nothing last night to change his trajectory of this race, and the trajectory here is terrible for him. He is not winning. Hillary Clinton is winning this race, and it's not close. You know, let's put it this way. At this point, if all Democratic groups vote basically the way they're telling pollsters at this point and come out at rates that were like past elections or even slightly less, Hillary Clinton's going to be the next president of the United States. But people still haven't voted. So there is still that caveat, of course. But, you know, look, in 2012, President Obama was up 6 points in February of 2012 against Mitt Romney. He was up only 1 point at this time in 2012, according to the Real Clear Politics average. He wound up winning by four. His campaign always had him up four, to be fair to them. And it was not – that was not a close election. Elections are supposed to get closer as you get toward Election Day, not further apart. And that's what this one's been doing.
Well, you say so Donald Trump didn't change his trajectory, but did he, you know, land any blows? I mean, he accused Hillary Clinton of dirty politics. He said she was responsible for the women who've come out to accuse him of sexual assault. Then he accused the Clinton campaign of planting people to disrupt his rallies. This was the allusion to an edited video that was out this week from Republican activist James O'Keefe, in which a liberal activist seems to be boasting about arranging for how, you know,
who was not paid by the Clinton campaign.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the slippery slope kind of stuff that he likes to talk about. You know, that if you take one piece of kernel of something that seems to be fishy here or there, then I'm going to connect everybody and connect the dots because, you know, it must be happening. You know, these people, you know, that's not evidence based. That's not like reality. You know, he's judge and jury all the time. He said Hillary Clinton shouldn't even be running because she is unqualified to be president because she should be in jail because the FBI didn't put her in jail.
Well, let's hear what he did say, though, so that people, if they missed this moment or didn't know what it meant, this was this activist who was appearing to say that he could help people incite violence at Trump rallies and hitting buttons and getting Trump people to respond to them. And Donald Trump mentioned that again today in Ohio. Let's listen.
This is criminal behavior that violates centuries of tradition of peaceful, democratic elections. A campaign like Clinton's that will incite violence is truly a campaign that will do anything to win.
And so, Domenico, we're just wondering if this road that he's going down, is this, do you think, a part of setting up that there was something wrong with this campaign and this election?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's part of what he's trying to do, is to say that if he were to lose, it would be rigged, and that people need to go out and vote and make it a big win or whatever it is. I think a couple of things. We talk about Hillary Clinton being on her back foot. I thought she was on her back foot in a couple places last night where she was asked about her emails and asked about the foundation and having private meetings with donors who had contributed to the Clinton Foundation. She sidestepped that and deftly moved to a different topic. And Trump took the bait and went and started defending Russia and Putin, essentially, instead of going back at her and trying to box her in and make her answer those questions, which she wasn't able to do. So if you don't like Hillary Clinton, you were not reassured that she's honest and trustworthy last night. But there wasn't much that Trump did to go beyond the base.
And boy, if you're a high school or college debate team coaches, you got a real fun thing to watch. Domenico Montanaro, lead editor for politics at NPR. Thank you.
Thank you.
On November 8th, five states, California, Arizona, Nevada, Maine, and Massachusetts, are voting on whether to fully legalize adult recreational use of marijuana. Four other states, Florida, Arkansas, North Dakota, and Montana, are voting on whether to legalize medical marijuana. Now, marijuana has been decriminalized in 21 states, reducing the penalties, but the harshness of those penalties varies from state to state. In Nevada, one of the states voting on whether to fully legalize, medical marijuana is legal, and although recreational use has been decriminalized, punishment can still be tough. Joining us is Michael McAuliffe, a Nevada resident who has a felony marijuana conviction on his record. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And tell us what happened when you got that conviction. This goes back to 2010.
Yes, it does. Well, at that point, I had already been working for several years as a medical marijuana activist, and getting in front of President Obama at a town hall meeting, in addressing this issue, he had said, "I've stopped the prosecutions." We saw that as a green light, got our state and county business license, opened up a dispensary, and 6 months later got raided by the DEA. And in retrospect, they said that, well, we had to do something because so many places in that summer were challenging the constitutionality of the law in Nevada and were opening up these dispensaries. And so as a result, roughly 15 dispensaries got raided that day. And it turned out that every single one of us took a plea to avoid the heavy hammer of the federal government.
You took a plea, and the conviction was for possession with intent to distribute marijuana.
That's correct.
So what has that meant for you to have this felony conviction on your record?
Oh my God! It's a tremendous, and I should have listened to my sister, who said former law enforcement, who said you really have to fight this. Don't take a plea because you'll regret it every day. And I have, because felony convictions result in lifelong consequences such as loss of employment, loss of credit, loss of housing opportunity for people, and in my case in specific, also loss of my First Amendment rights. I had a federal judge tell me that I no longer had the right to speak to politicians even about medical cannabis reform. And so the result of felony conviction compromises people in ways that they can't even imagine when they first wind up in the situation to have to make that decision of whether to take a plea or whether to go to trial.
So if Nevada does vote to legalize recreational use of marijuana next month, will that mean anything for your felony conviction? Is there any chance of it being overturned?
Absolutely none. I don't have a dog in this fight, as it were, because my conviction came down as a result of a federal action. This will not change in any way, shape, or form. Nonetheless, I've been advocating the passage of Question 2 because I tell people, look, the arrest you prevent may be your own. And I do not want to have other people, young people who make mistakes, wind up with the lifetime implications of that felony conviction. We currently have roughly 137,000 prisoners in this country on any given day who are there for possession-based drug crimes. And there is an arrest every 25 seconds in this country for drug crimes. Drug prosecutions and marijuana prosecutions in specific arrests outweigh the number of violent crime arrests in this country. And that's just a shocking waste of our police resources.
Well, what do you think about that, that you've got this conviction on your record for something that the voters of your state and several other states may be about to say is perfectly fine in society?
Well, you know, people who advocate for social change, people who lead in anything from those on point in the military to people looking for civil rights change, when you're at the forefront, you have a risk of being wounded in action. And that's how I try to look at it. And I know that what I was doing was right. And this was just a consequence of that. The hope that I have is that there is a small but growing movement in Congress to expunge the records of people who have been convicted of marijuana crimes. Now, that's probably several years away at the least, and it will depend on more of the country going into a legalization direction, because you bring up a very valid point. How can you continue to stigmatize one group of people when the society and the country has essentially legitimized the conduct that they were convicted under?
If Nevada does legalize recreational use of marijuana, would you be able to open a dispensary there, or would you be banned from that because of your prior conviction?
Well, the specific statute has not been written and won't be written until next year if it does pass. As guidance of the medical marijuana laws that have been put in place in 2013, generally for people who have been convicted of violent crimes or of drug-related crimes, they are considered excluded persons and are not allowed to be in the industry for at least a period of 10 years. And especially with the new medical marijuana industry, it seems crazy to me that you have people who were most knowledgeable about this and who were already working with patients and had a good understanding of the complexities of the issue, and the state is saying, well, if you stayed underground and if you were careful and didn't get caught, you're fine. You can go do this. But if you were more public and, you know, you got tripped up somehow and you now have a drug conviction, no, we don't care about your expertise. We're not going to let you take part in this industry.
That's Michael McAuliffe joining us from Las Vegas. He's got a felony marijuana conviction on his record, and Nevada voting next month on whether to legalize recreational marijuana. Michael, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, one state that has already legalized recreational marijuana is Alaska. It did so 2 years ago, but Alaskans still can't buy pot legally anywhere, at least for the next few weeks. Zach Hughes is a reporter with Here Now contributor Alaska Public Media. He joins us from Fairbanks. Hi, Zach.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And the pot industry was supposed to be up and running by January 1st of this year in Alaska, but the state still hasn't opened its first legal pot shop. What's the holdup?
Well, everything you could possibly imagine, really. Alaska was expected to have its regulations in place by the start of the year, and they more or less did at the state level. The problem came when municipalities had to get in line behind them and also draft regulations and decide how to mesh them with the state laws. And then that kicked off a whole round of voting about whether people at the local level, our counties, our boroughs, our towns, even wanted marijuana to go forward. And there were several voter initiatives to block it there. So, you know, the short answer to your question is regulation kind of has kept this held up, but it's marched forward, and we're expecting shops to start opening by the end of the year.
So what about the issue of transportation and the remoteness of some of the cities in Alaska? I know that that has also caused some delay.
Yeah, many of Alaska's communities are what we call off-the-road system. They're not connected to any sort of contiguous road, either to the lower 48 or even to the population centers in Anchorage or Fairbanks and, you know, what we call the road system. So for those communities, there's really not an option that satisfies both state and federal laws. Communities where you have to either fly in or boat to, you know, there's no solution that meshes with the federal ban on transporting a controlled substance on an airplane, let's say, or over water, which is regulated by the Coast Guard. There's really the still kind of outstanding question of whether federal agencies will take an interest in this, or how it'll mesh, or whether people should expect to get some of their goods and product confiscated or seized. And even our capital, Juneau, there's not really a way to get a lot of marijuana back and forth from there because there's no road connecting it to the road system. I spoke to Mark Malagodi, who's one of the, he's the CEO of a business called CanTest. That's a lab testing facility that'll be on the road system. And for him, this is a lost business opportunity because for a lot of businesses off the road system, there's just no way that they can move products to their facility and eventually to market.
If you take Nome, just as one example, there will likely be maybe two cultivators possibly there, maybe a retail store. There's no way that two cultivators can support a lab. It's just, I mean, it's impossible. So, you know, are they saying that there can't be any industry in Nome? That's essentially what they're saying.
And what Malagodi is referring to there is the incredible expense it takes to get these labs up and running. You know, all the product that's grown has to go to them to be checked for stuff like E. coli and mold, and they're enormously expensive, especially here where just generally the cost of things is so much more. People I spoke with didn't want to go into specifics about costs, citing competitiveness, but we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars to just get stuff up and running, even before you're paying for lab techs to maintain the businesses and potentially expand them going forward. So a smaller community like Nome of, you know, less than 4,000 people just doesn't have that capital to support a business like that and have its own lab. So it has to send product to the road system to get it tested. And right now there's no federally sanctioned, fully legal way to do that.
So Alaska dealing with some unique challenges as it tries to adjust to the world of recreational marijuana being legal there. Zach Hughes at Alaska Public Media in Fairbanks, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And if you receive Social Security, you may have heard the news this week that your check will not be increasing much next year. The Social Security Administration announced that the benefit would increase by about 0.3%. That's around $5 a month. But as the money you get barely inches up, those with higher incomes will be contributing more, as we heard Hillary Clinton say last night. Here to explain is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's in New York. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Robin. Good to see you.
Good to hear from you. And now about 1 in 5 Americans are on Social Security. Why such a small increase, especially if we're going to be getting more from others? And how does it compare to recent years for those who don't follow this?
Well, the increase is determined by law. It's determined by a sort of a basket of goods that represent inflation, and that basket of goods was actually 0.3%. So they can't actually do anything about that. What a lot of advocates argue for is that 60% of all seniors rely on Social Security for at least half of their monthly income. So rather than using this generalized basket of inflation, use a basket that's substantially more relevant to senior citizens. And the examples they give would suggest that if they did that, seniors would see a bigger increase than this 0.3%.
And this small increase could particularly be a problem because some retirees may have higher health care costs.
Yeah. In fact, if you're on Medicare, Medicare premiums will be announced. The increase will be announced in November, generally speaking. But that's also based on the same basket of goods. So it's likely that Medicare will be increased by 0.3%, which means if you're a senior citizen and you're on Medicare, you're getting the 3% increase in Social Security, and you're probably going to see it all disappear into Medicare. So that's a problem. In fact, 30% of Medicare beneficiaries are likely to be paying higher premiums in 2017.
Well, so talk about the higher income Americans who are going to be paying more. And then in general, what are the candidates saying about this? And I mean, that's always been a suggestion. Why don't people who make more pay more into Social Security? Now you've got the largest increase in more than 30 years.
Yeah, so it's a big increase. The percentage that people pay was 6.2%. You know, that's going to be increased to 6.2%. So people who make a lot of money, if you make over $127,200, you're going to be contributing more to Social Security. This is obviously part of the larger problem, and that is that Social Security may not remain solvent for a long time. In 2020, we're going to get to the point where Social Security and Medicare are taking in less than they are giving out, and estimates are that by 2034, they'll run out. Now, Chris Wallace asked the candidates last night what they would do. Neither suggested something like a grand bargain where there would be tax hikes and benefit cuts to sustain Social Security and Medicare. In fact, Trump didn't talk about it much at all. Hillary Clinton says that her tax hikes will be used to bolster Social Security.
What about pushing the age back as people live longer?
Right. That's the other logical suggestion. I mean, we do live longer. We tend to work longer. You know, this is like comprehensive tax reform. All the good thinking on this has been done. It simply requires political will, but it will require bipartisanship, something, you know, we take all the bipartisanship we can muster and use it just to pass a federal budget. So we'll have to wait for this one. Yeah.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, congratulations on the new position, and economics correspondent. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you more.
Bye-bye.
And it's off the national radar, but the protest near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota continues. Thousands of Native Americans from across the country have gathered to protest the proposed pipeline they say would disturb Native burial grounds and pollute drinking water. The Dallas-based company Energy Transfer Partners says the pipeline will bring crude oil from North Dakota to refineries more safely than trucks or trains. Last month, a federal judge gave the green light for the project, but shortly after, the Obama administration stepped in to temporarily halt it. Well, there's been news. Yesterday, tribal leaders voted to build a more permanent structure on their private land to get the 700 to 1,000 protesters that are there out of tents and teepees as the North Dakota winter moves in. And tribal leaders decided to add a homeschool resource center for the kids who've come with families. But state officials say it is illegal, and they fear the protesters will try to get it accredited. Elena Eagleshield is a language specialist for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota. She's a liaison between the homeschool and the local school district. And Elena, we welcome you, but we know you have a traditional greeting for us.
Hello, thank you for having me. Elena Eagleshield, Machiapi, Yuha Chante Washenape, Chiuzapi, Wazia Ekta Lakota Mokocheki, Yuoslaha Mataha. Like I just said, my name is Elena Eagleshield. I'm from Standing Rock, and I shake your hand with a heartfelt handshake. So it's basically our hello.
I shake your hand with a heartfelt handshake. That's great. So tell us about what you first called the Resource Center. We understand it started when the protests did. Why?
Because when it very first started, all these people that were coming and picking up our chanupa, and it's a sacred pipe, and there's a protocol for how you handle that. There are certain songs you sing when you're offering prayers. There's certain tobacco that you use when you put in that pipe. And what we were noticing, and not only myself or my coworkers, but a lot of the elders were telling us that there's people here that are doing things wrong. And so what we were thinking was go into the camp to see what kind of resources are out there, such as language and culture and any expertise in traditional healing or anything that anybody in the camp had to offer. We need to create these opportunities. This is a historic event, and we need to gather all these knowledge keepers. Let them share their knowledge, you know, just share what they know so that we're not doing anything wrong.
We understand as well that people have brought their children, and the longer this goes on, the children are missing school.
Yeah, so why were they protecting the water for our children? We all agreed the best way that we knew that that would work out is creating a homeschool resource center so that not only their children can be educated, but they will not get, you know, charged with truancy, or so they won't get any misdemeanors for not having their kids in school.
Well, and you have, and the protesters behind this have been citing the allowable home education provisions of the North Dakota Century Code, Section 15.1. This is the right to homeschool children. As we said, the state superintendent says that they fear that this is sort of inching towards asking for an accredited school. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe spokesperson says, we are just doing homeschooling?
Yes. They were trying to put it out there that we were applying for a school, and that was never the intention.
It's interesting. You're a language specialist. We were just in Oklahoma and visited the Chickasaw Nation and the efforts there to save their language. Is this kind of re-energizing what has felt like a dormant Native people's pride movement?
Definitely. I've been out there since the beginning of August when it all first started happening, and before this, obviously, I was learning my language, practicing my ways. My dad is a fluent speaker, and he is really, really, really passionate about our culture and our traditions and our history. And so I grew up hearing stories of the Battle of Little Bighorn. I grew up hearing stories of, you know, Sitting Bull and all these different amazing stories, and also the sad history that we've had. And to see this camp, to be out there, to see all the amazing, you know, relatives working together, it brings, I can't even put it into words. It's the most amazing feeling I've ever felt. And I feel this way after I hear fluent speakers speak. I feel this way after I go to a ceremony that is ours. You know, like, I've always known who I am and who my people are, who I come from. But being out there is something that I could never put into words. It's the most beautiful place that I've ever been, where we're all just gathering because they know we have something right. You know, they know that we have this connection with Creator and the earth and water and animals that nobody else has, you know, and it's just beautiful. I offer up my home to any of the teachers who want to come, people who need to shower. My family has a camp set up. We've been offering that up to people who come and help with the school. There's my mom and dad and my uncles. They have a couple of campers out there that they're just offering up. And so we'll be here as long as there are people who need help.
That's Elena Eagleshield, language specialist for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota, part of the ongoing protest against the proposed pipeline there. Elena, thanks for talking to us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Well, walk a few hundred yards into the woods around Durham, Connecticut, and you'll see something that looks like it's out of Mad Max. Large trucks, big wheels, giant robotic arms, grabbing trees and slicing them down. This controlled chaos is a calculated timber harvest with the long-term goal of creating a more resilient forest. Patrick Scahill from Here and Now contributor WNPR reports.
Months of planning has led to this.
People generally don't appreciate the way it looks right now. In a few years, it will look very different, so they might have a different appreciation.
Lindsay Sir is with the Connecticut Forest and Parks Association and we're at Field Forest, about 25 miles south of Hartford. And after a lot of time spent marking trees and planting cuts, trees are falling, leaving behind piles of logs and branches and stumps. It's messy.
People are like, well, the forest will do it itself. Why are we in here wreaking havoc on the forest?
Eventually, this forest would regenerate itself, but forester Eric Hansen says the cutback he and his crew are doing speeds up that process, removing trees that otherwise would rot and die on their own.
For the most part, what we're trying to do here is a thinning of the overstory.
As we walk deeper into the woods, Hansen says it's important loggers create openings that essentially let the forest breathe, giving trees space to open up their crowns and giving the forest floor more opportunity to absorb light. Hansen says the key word is diversity.
So if you look up, you can see that there is probably, you know, maybe about a quarter acre opening in the canopy here. So it's going to encourage what we would call moderately shade tolerant to shade tolerant species to come back. So in this particular case, that means sugar maple, that means ash, that probably means red maple.
Hansen points to the ground, and the little seedlings are there, popping up, and because of the cut, now bathed in light.
Yeah, this stuff will be able to, what we call, become established with the additional sunlight and start to become the next generation of this forest.
Hansen says loggers created about 10 or so openings of this size. Jared Bellows is one of those loggers. He points out a large trail of brush and slash that he's left behind as trees fell.
We do that deliberately so that if water does drain down it, it gets kind of mixed up with that brush and it slows the water down so it doesn't carry the sediment with it.
Deeper in the woods, a big machine called a forwarder stacks piles of logs. Some of them will get shipped overseas. Forester Eric Hansen points to one tree that's not for sale. It's a sickly-looking ash tree that's fallen victim to the emerald ash borer, or EAB. Now the tree-killing pest has attracted the interest of a woodpecker.
I mean, you can see some of this light-colored stuff on this side of the this fork. That's a process that we call blonding, which is created by woodpeckers who are knocking off just the outside part of the bark to be able to get at the larvae of EAB, which are just underneath.
Hansen says he was out here months ago tagging trees, deciding which ones to cut. This ash tree was alive and well then, which shows just how dire the situation is for ash trees in the U.S. Since its discovery in 2002, emerald ash borer has spread to 28 states, moving as far west as Colorado. Still, as Hansen recounts biological and chemical efforts to combat EAB and keep ash trees alive, he's trying to stay optimistic.
It's not a foregone conclusion that we are absolutely going to lose all of our ash.
Especially, Hansen says, the generation of seedlings lining the forest floor that can now get a little bit more sunlight as loggers work to open up the woods. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Scahill.
How did last night's debate play with women? Up until now, Hillary Clinton has been winning with women voters, according to the polls. And joining us now is Michelle Bernard, president and CEO of the Bernard Center for Women Politics and Public Policy. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's great to have you. And we've got to start with one of the big moments from last night. Here it is. Here's Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
What we want to do is to replenish the Social Security Trust Fund by making sure that
you heard him say they're such a nasty woman. How harmful is something like that for Trump with women voters?
Oh, it's enormously harmful. I will tell you that I suspect that millions of American women all over the United States today, and probably women from all over the world who watched the debate last night, are celebrating women's nastiness and will wear that as a badge of honor. It was an absolutely horrible, horrible statement for Donald Trump to make. It was incredibly condescending. And whether people like Hillary Clinton or not, she was answering the questions. She was incredibly thoughtful in every response that she gave with respect to policy. And Trump's calling her a nasty woman was seen, I believe, as a way to bring her down and make himself sort of pump himself up. It was completely uncalled for. And I think he did himself a lot of damage. I frankly would not be surprised if when he went home last night, both his wife and his daughter asked him what on earth was he thinking about.
Because women outside of that room took that as an attack on all women, or because they felt sympathetic toward Hillary Clinton when he said that?
Actually, both. I mean, you would feel sympathy for Hillary Clinton when he said it. Not that she is, this sort of fallen princess who needs sympathy from the world, because it was very clear that she could handle him. But outside of that, it appeared to be Donald Trump's way of thinking about women in general. It was very reminiscent of women in the workplace who believe that when a woman is in charge and speaks in a certain way, she's considered, you know, somehow nasty, versus when a man speaks in the same sort of tone or framework, he is looked at as being a leader and as being strong. And every woman in the United States at one point or time, whether she works outside of the home or inside the home, has felt that kind of demeaning attitude.
Let's listen to Hillary Clinton here, and it really sounds here like she was appealing directly to women voters.
Donald thinks belittling women makes him bigger. He goes after their dignity, their self-worth, and I don't think there is a woman anywhere who doesn't know what that feels like. So we now know what Donald thinks and what he says and how he acts toward women. That's who Donald is. I think it's really up to all of us to demonstrate who we are.
Now, as we said, Hillary Clinton is already leading among women voters, but do you think that she was trying to get even more last night?
You know, I do. I have an interesting take on that. I think everything that she did last night was clearly an attempt to generate more support from women voters. However, I honestly felt that Hillary Clinton's statement in the clip that you just played was particularly important because I feel that she was speaking to men also, to men who have young daughters, who will have to deal with a Trump presidency and the culture that he would bring to America's democracy and to the White House and to the culture of how men treat women in the workplace. I think she was really speaking to those men to say, if you vote for Donald Trump, this is what you would be wreaking on your wife, on your daughter, on your granddaughters. This is the America that you would be putting in as head of state.
Michelle Bernard, how much do you think gender is going to matter at the end of the day in this election? Obviously, we've never had a female president in this country before. It hasn't come up that much as a direct issue in the campaign, but of course a lot of people can point to various things and say indirectly it has been an issue. But what do you think? Is it going to be crucial for this election when we look back on it 10 or 15 years from now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, every election that we have had in the United States in recent years, there is always a significant gender gap where we see more women than men voting for the Democratic candidate. Republicans and Democrats need women to vote in elections. And although we haven't really seen a direct hit where people say, I absolutely have to get the women's vote, but we know that it exists. It's why we talk about the gender gap. It's why we saw, for example, Donald Trump's daughter at the Republican convention speaking directly to women about the issues that she feels are important to women. The empowerment of women and the sort of establishment of gender equality are absolutely crucial to democracy in the United States. And so, you know, for that reason alone, Hillary Clinton needs the women's vote, and so does Donald Trump. And quite frankly, the people who vote for Trump, in light of everything that we have seen come out over the last few weeks, will have to really dig down deep and ask themselves a question, you know, is this how we want to treat American women and our women's rights, human rights, or not?
That's Michelle Bernard, the president and CEO of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young. It's Here and Now.